And welcome to another edition of Odyssey. I'm your host, Mike Schultz. We talk about ancient mysteries and modern mysteries all across the globe. And it's been a while. I've been on hiatus for a month or so. Time to recharge my batteries. And I'm based in Portland, Oregon. I have a television show up here and my movies that I produce and the radio show. So I'm juggling many different projects, and it was good to have a bit of a hiatus, but I am back. And since I've been gone, there's been this tremendous money crisis all across the globe. It's we've really been to hell and back. So I thought it would be appropriate tonight if I tell you a story. This happens to be a true story that you may not have heard in your history books or read about when you were growing up in school. Of course, you learn the stories of the Revolution and Paul Revere and the Declaration of Independence and the Liberty Bell and all of that, but you may not have heard the tale of the creature from Jekyll Island. So we're going to get into that, and that is, it talks about our money system and how it was actually stolen away from the American people and is now held by a private cartel of banks. So once again, it's called The Creature from Jekyll Island, and that's spelled exactly like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, appropriate as we head into Halloween here. And it's an actual place, Jekyll Island. So let me read you a bit, and then I'll comment. The story begins in the year 1910. A group of extremely powerful banking families began to conspire to take over the banking system of the U.S. government. People like Nelson Aldridge, a relative of the Rockefellers, J.P. Morgan, a powerful magnate who is the basis for the cartoon character of the banker in the Monopoly game, and Paul Warburg, who was depicted as Daddy Warbucks in the Orphan Annie cartoons, among others, all these powerful men hatched a very secret plan. These three, plus four other powerful bankers, traveled incognito by train to Jekyll Island off the coast of southern Georgia. They used secret names on the train so that they would not be recognized. They rendezvoused for 9 days on a private, remote Jekyll Island and came up with a plan to take over the U.S. banking system. They put together a cartel of private banks and called it the Federal Reserve to make it seem as if it were a department of our government and to make it seem as if they had reserves in gold and silver to back up all the paper. Neither was true, however. Their plan was to print paper money, not backed by gold, and lend it to Congress at interest. Congress, in turn, would spend this money that they often had trouble getting from the taxpaying public. So Congress, in a way, liked this plan. So it allowed Congress to overspend. They had great difficulty getting their secretive bill through Congress, as many senators saw right through it, and they were, you know, trying to protect the people and do the right thing. But finally, after a couple years, in 1913, they were able to put enough safety provisions in the bill to have it passed, while many Congress members were away right before Christmas in 1913. After the bill was passed, they stripped away many of these safety provisions, unfortunately. So how does this affect you today? Well, we have a private cartel controlled by the Rockefellers and Rothschilds families loaning money to our government at interest. So instead of going directly to our government for a loan to buy a house at 0 or 1% interest, you must pay a much higher rate of interest so they can pay it back to the Federal Reserve, once again, a private cartel of banks. If you had a mortgage with no interest payments, or if you had a mortgage at zero interest, let's say, it could be paid off in 7 or 8 years. So most people could own their homes free and clear at a relatively young age. If they bought a home at 30, they could be free and clear by age 37, which is pretty amazing. They could have freedom to do enjoyable things with their lives. But as it stands now, many people have to take a job that they dislike and keep it for 30 years to pay off all the interest accrued on a house on a standard 30-year mortgage. Generally, this interest is so much money that it is more than the original purchase price of a house. If you buy a house at, you know, $100,000 at 5.5% interest, over 30 years, you're going to end up paying over $300,000 for that house. So once again, most of that money is going to interest. There's only a few political parties that I know of that are trying to correct this situation, and they are alternative third parties such as the Constitution Party, which is also known as the American Independent Party, and the American First Party, and a somewhat libertarian party as well. And these are on the ballot in all 50 states, so please keep this in mind. So there's an author who wrote a great book called The Creature from Jekyll Island, and his name is Ed Griffin. And what you can do is go on Yahoo or Google on the computer and just type that in, Creature from Jekyll Island, and you will get a free video, and you can watch him. You can watch Ed Griffin explain this whole mystery and the background of the Federal Reserve banking system. And remember, federal is just an adjective. For instance, Federal Express is not part of our government. It's a private business, a delivery service. So just because you see federal on a dollar bill, it's merely an adjective. And so these powerful, secretive families, they've always been involved in fractional banking, going back to the Masons and the Knights Templar in Europe. Fractional banking simply means you may only have $1,000 of gold in your bank, but you're loaning out 10 times that, $10,000 in paper. And from 1913 until the 1970s, we kept getting more and more fractional banking, less and less gold covering more and more paper and notes. Until finally, President Nixon was the last one to completely take us off the gold and silver standard. So now we have no backing whatsoever by gold and silver. And since the 1970s until now, you can see the repercussions and the fallout and how the dollar has fallen in value in regards to other currencies all around the world. So we do need to attack this problem at the root, at the source. Show this video to everyone you know. Knowledge is power. You call your congressman. And one by one, we get together and we solve this problem. I mean, that's the only way out of this situation. Like I said, you dig it out right at the root. So anyway, that's my commentary on the money system. And you know, when I was in college, just the best book I read was called Free to Choose, and by the Freedmans in my economics class, and that was just all about letting the marketplace dictate prices and services. And that's what America is all about, really, is just let the marketplace do its thing and government get out of the way. And if a loaf of bread sells for $5, fine. If it sells for $2, fine. The supply and demand will always correct itself. So that's a great book, the Milton Friedman, Free to Choose. So anyway, I'm going to shift gears here and tell you a bit about my new website. It's called mysteryislands.net, and it looks really great. I've worked with my designer on a nice design, and all three of my DVDs, which include this talk about the banking, the money system, are at this website. My second DVD, The Temples of Stone, is when I get into some modern-day mysteries like chemtrails and American Stonehenge and Jekyll Island and things like that. And that's, once again, The Temples of Stone, my second DVD. So please go to mysteryislands.net. And I've blown up the DVDs real large so you can see all the details. You can read all of the copy on the front and the back, and it's very specific to know exactly what you're delving into. I deal in specifics, not generalities, and I deeply dig into the ancient astronaut theory, this whole idea that there were giants or the Anunnaki who were on the Earth thousands of years ago, and they were controlling the situation. And they were building pyramids and mining for gold. And all that's really left is the legends and the Greek mythology of the gods and the Roman mythology of the gods and the Egyptian mythology of the gods and the Viking Norse mythology of the gods. And if you go to India, they will tell you elaborate, detailed stories of the fighting and wars and loves of the gods. And I don't believe it's mythology. I believe it's all based in fact, and this is our true history. Of course, some of it has been embellished, but the basis for all of this so-called mythology is the tales of the Anunnaki, the Nephilim of the Old Testament, the giants. So I've been doing research lately on the Americas, and we'll just start in 1492 when Columbus sailed to the West Indies, and it was a very exciting time. He went back to Spain the next year, and he convinced the king that he needed more ships to go back for more trading and discovery of the New World. And he did. He went back several times. And then some of the other Spanish explorers started to follow him. And they found that the Indians had some gold, some gold nuggets and some gold trinkets and jewelry, and they really were questioning them strongly as to where the source of this gold it was. And, you know, eventually, as we got into the 1500s and the years passed, they were drawn to places like Peru and central Mexico, and the Spanish were absolutely stunned when they finally arrived at the city of Cuzco, which is basically a city of gold. There were temples and palaces, and they even had a golden cornfield, if you can imagine, stalks of corn, thousands of them. They had a garden that was, all of the flowers in the garden were gold-plated, all kinds of jewelry and urns and vases, and it was incredible. And they were looking for El Dorado, this lost city of gold, and I think it was Cuzco. I think they did find the city of gold. It was Cuzco, but many of them didn't believe that, and they kept on looking for it forever. So, anyway, what was intriguing is that the Indians there, the Incas, were not really actively engaged in gold mining. There were not any active shafts where they were digging for gold. They had the treasure already. And they also weren't building these elaborate pyramids and temples. They were just living amongst them. So it's almost like there was a high society that was present before them, and it was starting to decay and crumble, and the Mayans and Aztecs and Incas were living amongst it. As far as the gold, they weren't using it for barter or money at all. In a way, they did not have a problem with giving a lot of it over to the Spanish, because they did not have a lot of use for it. Yes, it was pretty and beautiful, and it was everywhere, all of the jewelry and the statues. They gave it to Cortez. They thought he was Quetzalcoatl, the returning serpent god. And eventually what the Spanish ended up doing is kidnapping some of their kings or leaders and holding them for ransom and getting massive amounts of gold. We're talking thousands of tons of gold these first years in the 1500s, and bringing it back to Europe if they made it across the treacherous sea without, you know, pirates taking it. So once again, if the Incas had gone to this tremendous amount of effort to dig all this gold out of the ground and craft all of these statues and pyramids, they didn't appear to value it very highly. When they were questioned about it, they said, well, there were some gods that came before us, and the gold belongs to the gods, is what they said. It doesn't belong to us. It belongs to the gods, and it's for their purposes. So, and then they, in their mythology, in their legends, in the Mayan calendar, they refer to giants, actually. They refer to white-haired giants with white beards and pale skin. And to me, that's a dead giveaway. We are talking about the Anunnaki here. The Anunnaki came before them. And I believe, and this was around the time of Christ, I think, was the heyday of the civilization, when the Anunnaki were building all of these incredible temples all throughout the jungles of the Americas. And after they got their gold, they got what they needed, they abandoned abruptly all of these temples and pyramids. And once again, this is all theory. This is the ancient astronaut theory that I present, and I try to back it with as much hard evidence as I can, but it does fall in the category of theory. And then the Anunnaki have a history of building elaborate monuments, and then once they've served a purpose, they abandon them abruptly. Even the Great Pyramid was abandoned after its purpose, whatever that was served. So this was no different. In Central America, Peru, not so much the rest of South America, nothing really in the rest of South America. It was all in Peru. That's where it's at, because of those very, very high altiplane, you know, areas, 13,000 feet above the sea. And remember, this was after the flood. And these were the first floodwaters to recede. We're very, very high up. And sure enough, there is the city of the gods, Tiwanaku. Up there at the very top, right next to that giant lake, Lake Titicaca, and there's all of these drainage canals, and it very much appears they were doing metallurgy. they were cleaning out the gold and the tin and the copper, and very interested in combining tin and copper to create bronze. Bronzing was very important. And this requires a precise formula. It's not something that would be randomly kind of found by natives scavenging around, you know, chasing after animals and living in tents. This was very sophisticated, and it came along, like I said, I believe, before the Aztecs and Mayans came to that land. And so anyway, the Peru and the Yucatan Peninsula, which was the Mayan capital, and Central America, which was the Aztec capital, were the epicenter of this Anunnaki civilization. So there is some speculation that, if you remember in the Bible, the story of Cain and Abel, was there was a punishment by Jehovah when Cain killed Abel. And he was very angry, and he sent him off to the far western lands. And one of his sons was Enoch, and there is speculation that there's a mark of Cain, and what that mark of Cain was removing the facial hair and having a smooth facial hair, and that was the mark that made him different, and that was kind of the basis for the Incan civilization. So one of the other fascinating places where they went to find minerals and copper, and there's a reference to this in the Sumerian clay tablets, is northern Michigan. And there are extremely old copper mines to this day on the northern shores of the lakes around Michigan. And all of these strange tools and a tremendous amount of copper mining was done. Once again, the tablets talk about going to a northern area and bringing the copper out and taking it down with the tin of Peru and mixing it together in this precise formula to create bronze, and using bronze for their means, along with gold. And gold was so crucial to the Anunnaki. That was their main purpose. It's all throughout the Sumerian tablets, a tremendous focus on gold. And really the history of planet Earth, when I read these tablets, is intertwined with gold mining and slavery, as intertwined into our whole history. So anyway, that's covered in my three DVDs. The best one, probably the overview, if you just get one, is The Sands of Time. And that's at my website, mysteryislands.net. So please go check that out. And then if you want more advanced material, my second one is The Temples of Stone, and then the third one is Mystery Islands, the same name as the website. So please check out the pictures and see all the descriptions, and they're $20 each, and that includes shipping, and please check them out. So some of the other research I've done recently is about a giant volcanic eruption. So let me read this article to you, and then I'll comment. One of the greatest areas of speculation in the ancient astronaut field is when the last orbit of Nibiru, or Planet X, the home of the Anunnaki, occurred on Earth. The clay tablets state clearly that this orbit occurs every 3,600 years. And that's how they measured a lot of their time sequences, was in increments of 3,600 years. Many of these tablets date back to around 4,000 BC. And we know that an advanced society appeared suddenly in Sumeria with sophisticated language, writing, art, culture, mathematics, and astronomy. Many believe Nibiru orbited past planet Earth at this time, and a large group of Anunnaki settled this area of Sumeria, or modern-day Iraq. This crossing apparently can cause great catastrophe on Earth, or the changes and shifts can be minor. It just depends on the rotation. If it did cycle around 4,000 BC, then the next time it passed Earth's orbit would be around 1,500 BC. There was an incredible volcanic eruption, perhaps the greatest in history, that occurred around this time of 1,500 BC, according to radiometric data. It occurred on the island of Santorini in Greece. To this day, it's a major tourist attraction, as visitors can see the massive sheer cliffs that formed a few curved islands. This archipelago is all that remains of the once giant volcano that exploded during this era. The Old Testament documents many archaeological disasters during this era, leading to the mass exodus of the Jews out of Egypt. The theory is that the parting of the Red Sea was caused by a massive tsunami when the Santorini volcano erupted. If Nibiru crossed at this time, it may well have been responsible for the great shift upon the land. The next cycling of Planet X, according to this theory, would be 3,600 years after the volcanic eruptions, which occurred around 1500 BC. That would take us right to the 21st century, or today. And many people believe 2012 is when that Planet X is going to come around again. But, of course, great debate on that subject. Everyone seems to have a different opinion. And in my research, I never pinpoint specific years or make predictions with specific years. It could, you know, it could be off by 50 years. We don't know. So the oval-shaped or elliptical orbit of Nibiru would keep it shielded behind the sun during its current journey. Only time will tell if this theory is indeed correct. So that's one of my articles on Planet X. And, you know, I always take kind of a scattershot approach on my radio show and kind of salt and pepper you with different aspects of the ancient astronaut theory. But if you want a methodical, direct approach with all of the pictures to guide you through it, if it's a bit confusing, please go to my website, mysteryislands.net, and buy the first one, The Sands of Time, and that will take you through methodically, step by step, from the oldest documents we have, dating back to 4000 BC, to the present. So the format's a little bit different on my show. We're going to have Linda Torres come on pretty soon. She is going to host the second half of Odyssey, and she is an expert in angels, and she is going to give out live angel readings on the air, so be prepared for that, okay? It's coming up in a few minutes, and she's a very nice lady. I know her personally. She's also in Portland, and very giving and generous, and I have the healing blessing angels now around this show, and I'm very happy for that. So anyway, I'm going to give you one or two more little articles here, and then we'll go ahead and do that change. Let's talk about an American Stonehenge. There's a small version of the stone monolith in England known as Stonehenge that is located in America. This huge granite monument has a mysterious history and is known as the Georgia Guidestones. In 1979, a man who went by the false name R.C. Christian hired a granite company to build the monument in Elbert County, Georgia. He represented an unnamed group in America. The giant tablets are written in English, as well as ancient languages that nobody speaks today, such as hieroglyphics from Egypt and Babylonian cuneiform, which is unrelated to any human language and was used in ancient Sumeria. Many speculate that R.C. Christian is a reference to the founder of the esoteric belief system, the Rosicrucians, Christian Rosencrantz. The large stones are aligned with astronomical events such as the equinox, just like Stonehenge. A slot is carved in the stones, which are 19 feet high, and the sun shines through at precisely the winter and summer equinox. The first message on the stone states a goal of maintaining the human population at 500 million. This is chilling, considering the current population on Earth is over 6 billion. In other words, R.C. Christian and his group want a 90% reduction in the population. Another message recommends the formation of a world court to resolve disputes between nations. This reference to a world court is a tip-off that we are dealing with a secretive group that is trying to create a new world order or one world government. These powerful secretive groups have worked behind the scenes with the goal of depopulation and limiting growth. So the reference to ancient languages and giant monolith aligned to the planets is another indicator that the Guidestones were created by a group that traced their heritage back to the mystery schools of Egypt and Babylonian history. A logical choice or idea for this unnamed group of Americans who created the Georgia Guidestones are the Freemasons, but this is an educated guess since it was built anonymously. So once again, that was back in 1979, and you can check them out if you're in the southern part of the country. You can go to Georgia and see the Georgia Guidestones. And they are, there's pictures of them in my third DVD, Mystery Islands. So please check that out. It's a kind of an esoteric site that not many people know of. So we'll get to a few more little articles here. We cover, the major ancient sites around the world that we cover are Angkor Wat, which is really important. In Cambodia. It was a major site, the largest religious structure in the world. And it was really hidden in the jungles, and it's surrounded by a moat that's a mile long, and there's all kinds of elaborate artwork and of the gods at war and at play in the walls of the jungle. So this was built later, about 1000 AD, and it was built by humans for sure, you know, by the slaves or the serfs at the time. But I do believe the engineers behind it were the Anunnaki, because it was so elaborate and so much more complex than the kind of villages that were built around the jungles at this time. And that's what we're looking for in my field. We're looking for elaborate stone monuments with, you know, detail and aligned to the stars and complex construction methods being used and extremely old very, very heavy granite and stone and andesite blocks that are cut out and carved from a stone quarry that in many cases is 100 miles away. Certainly in Stonehenge, it's 100 miles away or more. So